homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. The correct ordering of daily life. Somebody's asked me about this recently, and it caused a number of different threads to come together. And also, we recently received these books, which are biographies of people of the Buddha's time. And I've been talking from them, from the books, on a couple of occasions before, because they're about lay training. So let's see if this works. And in the Buddha's time, as I've said before, people were not all that different than they are now, particularly in regards to their koan and their training. And also people have asked about the difference between lay and monastic training, because some people worry about that. So, during the Buddha's time, there was a government minister in one of the countries that were there. India, northern India, was divided up with a large number of different countries, small and large. Some were monarchies, some were republics, etc. And this minister did some great service to the country. And so he was going to be rewarded for this. And I think of it as a sort of combination of the lottery and King for a Day. And how he was going to be rewarded was he would be able to basically enjoy the state of being the king for a day. I don't think he had to do any legislation or anything along those lines, but he could live in the royal palace and basically enjoy himself. So, you know, there were a lot of events put on for it. There was going to be musicians and entertainers and nice food, if you sort of think of what that would be like. Nice food, and also a chance to ride on the royal elephant. Which to me is a very nice, thrilling thing, although I've never been on an elephant, but I adore them whenever I've actually seen them. When I was a teenager, actually, a circus came to St. John's, and by accident on our way in, they were bringing the elephants in. And it was one of the events in my life that actually very much convinced me about past existences. Because even though I'd never encountered one, I was so thrilled just to have the elephants pass by me. Just, it was one of the most thrilling, I can remember it, gosh, more than 50 years later. In any case, this minister, as I say, they were doing all the preparations for the feast and the entertainment. And part of the entertainment was the king's theater troupe and dance troupe would perform, okay, for this man. So all the dancers were readying themselves, and they wanted to, in order to honor this minister, they wanted to get everything as right as possible. So one of the women dancers, I gather, although they didn't quite put it this way in the story, she wanted to be in top form, okay, for the dance. So she deliberately fasted for, I don't know how long it was, maybe 24 hours. So she would be in top form. And then when the day came and the performance was going on, in the middle of the dance, she keeled over of a heart attack and died. This was such a profound shock to the minister that he immediately got up on the royal elephant and went off to see the Buddha, who he had known before. Okay. There's a technical term in Buddhist literature for what happened to him. I don't remember the Pali word. It means to have a deep insight to the real nature of things. So he went to see the Buddha in order to ask him. And the people in those days in that era were very protocol conscious. So technically speaking, he should have gone and seen the Buddha either on foot or, you know, gone with the elephant to some degree. But he was still perched. He was so eager to find out, so anxious to find out, that he was actually on the elephant when he asked the Buddha. And the Buddha explained it to him. And the minister became an arhant right on the spot. This illustrates the nature of lay and monastic training. It isn't about being in a particular state or circumstances. It has to do with the training of the person concerned. If you understand what I mean. In the description of this person, they say, you know, the monks were talking about it among themselves because it was extraordinary. Right smack in the middle of enjoying all the luxuries of the world while sitting on the royal elephant, perfumed and, you know, wearing these nice silks and clothes, this person had the deepest form of insight into the teaching of the Buddha. That the person did so was not dependent upon the lay or monastic state. It had to do with the
receptivity.
Whatever. They were ready. Do you understand what I mean? And particularly if you go away and think about it a bit, you will see. So that's why the whole question of lay monastic training is so difficult to kind of talk about it and explain. Because it is, if I can put it that way, outside the world of the opposites. It has to do with people training themselves. And last time, although I don't know if it was on Thursday or Saturday, I talked about this woman who had been she was a servant in another royal household. And every day she was given 8 coins to go and buy flowers in the marketplace. If you've ever read about India, aside from the abundance of flowers, people use them every day, you know, to decorate things, to decorate themselves. So this woman was very good at buying things. So she spent half the amount and kept the other half. Now, she was a hunchback and due to previous karma and was, you know, an ordinary person, been doing this for some years and didn't really give it much thought, really. She didn't know anything about the Buddha. Just one day on her way to purchase the flowers or on her way back, she saw a group of people listening to this teacher, and it struck her as interesting, so she stopped for a few minutes to hear. And she became a stream entrant right there and then. And what's interesting is the scripture says, the story says, she didn't even realize this had occurred. So that means that it couldn't have been some sort of spectacular, you know, insight for her. But what she immediately did was go back to the place of employment and tell her employer that she'd been, stealing this money for a period of time, that she'd been given eight coins a day, but had only spent four of them and kept the rest. And as a result of that, the employer, the queen, had a great deal of respect for her. I think this may be that she wasn't a particularly difficult person before, but the queen had a great deal of respect for her and honored her as her teacher and asked her to go and hear the Buddha teach every day and come back and relay the teaching to the women in the palace, which is what this woman did. And years later, I mean, she spent the rest of her life doing this, actually. That, and it says she, continued to train herself. And after the Buddha passed away, on, I think, the second council, when they were rehearsing the Buddha's teachings, the teachings that she had conveyed, that she had remembered, she was also said to be a very good memory and a very good sharp mind. So the teachings that she had heard the Buddha give and conveyed to the ladies in the palace were then entered into the Buddhist scriptures at that time. And the reason we still have them is because of this woman. Another story is of a couple, a married couple, an old married couple, who when they encountered the Buddha, called him son, and treated him as if he was their son. And some people around the Buddha were inclined to think the old couple were crazy. But the Buddha said, no, they were my parents for many, many, many existences. And so he went and visited them whenever he was in the area. And they too continued to train themselves throughout the rest of their lives. What I like about these stories is that, and I hope this is recording okay. No, I keep on looking away and looking up, you see.
You shouldn't move it around because it'll transmit into the thing.
Okay. I just wonder when I speak out, but anyway.
Well, I've been watching it.
Okay. Oh, yeah, because I'm there. Is the ordinariness of the people's lives. They were not lives of extraordinary people. They were the lives of ordinary people like ourselves, training themselves, encountering with daily life, and not separating themselves from daily life. I think what strikes me is the people who succeeded were not people who had extravagant thoughts about what karma, training was, and doing great analysis of it. They just practiced. One of my favorite stories, and I read these when I was in university. This is right here. Sorry. This is one of the volumes collection of the stories. Is Kisagotami, who's a very famous story, but I've seen it translated in very bad ways. Kisagotami was a young woman, got married, and could not get any respect from her in-laws, although her husband respected her. And the story says this is rather odd because she brought prosperity to the family. And then in the course of time, she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. That is a grandson for that family, which is very important to them. And they began to respect her. The story says that she was a small stature woman. So the child was born, and as women did in those days, she carried the child about with her everywhere. And the child got a fever and rather quickly died. And Kisugo Tami became completely distraught when people tried to convince her to let go of the body. She wouldn't. And she kept on saying that the child was not dead, but just needed the right medicine. And so she wandered about, distraught, with the child's corpse on her hip, asking for medicine, asking for help from passersby, who tended to think she was crazy, which to a degree she was, and not pay her any attention. She had never encountered the Buddha before, but there was a wise man who she knew and who said, why don't you go? There's a sage, Siddhartha Gautama, living nearby. Why don't you go and talk to him? So she went to the Buddha, and again, she didn't know the Buddha. She thought he was some sort of physician. And also, sages and renunciates in those days did give medical advice, particularly if they'd been doctors before they renounced the world. And so she asked the Buddha for medicine. And the Buddha said, fetch me mustard seed, black mustard seed, this particular amount, a tala, black mustard seed. Now, that was very, very common for people to do. That is, you would go to a physician and the physician would say, go and get me so much medicine or an herb or something like that from the market, bring it back, and then the doctor would compound it and tell them how to use it. So she wouldn't have been surprised by this. And so she went looking for the mustard seed with the corpse of her child on her hip. And the Buddha said, okay, but there's one condition. And again, people wouldn't have found this unusual that there was a condition put upon it, because sometimes there were superstitions. You know, you get the medicine, but you have to not get it from this particular place, or you have to get it from this particular place, or stuff like that. Because the thing with these stories of what happened is that the reason many of these people don't express surprise at what would surprise us is because this was the usual run-of-the-mill. So the Buddha said, you have to get mustard borrow it from your neighbors. But it can't come from any house where someone has died. And so Kisugo Tami rushed off, thinking that, you know, all she had to do was get the medicine, get the mustard seed, which was used, you know, as a medicine in those days, and it still is in India, ground mustard seed, particularly for things of the lungs, and which maybe was what was wrong with her child, I don't know. But she went from door to door in the little village and knocked on the door, and the story says people were very kind. She said, I need mustard seed. I've been sent to get mustard seed. And they would say, I mean, it was a common household thing, so they would bring out the mustard seed, and she would say, but it can't have come from a household where anybody has died. Now, also in this story, I think it's likely that she people superstitious at the time would have thought it was inauspicious to get a medicine from where somebody had died, if you see what I mean. So she wouldn't have thought about it, thought in terms of, gosh, this is a strange request. But each household where she went, given that these were large compounds of multi-families living together, the people said, well, yes, you know, our child died recently, or our grandmother passed away not very long ago. And she couldn't find, Kisukotami couldn't find a house in the village where nobody had died. And it struck her with a great deal of force, the what is called in Buddhism the truth, the first noble truth, the existence of suffering. And actually, for that matter, the second one too, about how when we get wrapped up entirely in our own suffering, it's a frequent enough observance that when people are in a great deal of pain or in a great deal of difficulty, it tends to make them not very sympathetic to other people. People tend to get wrapped up in their own pain and difficulties. And with that came the realization that the child was actually dead and that there was nothing she could do about it. In those days, and still in India, there were charnel grounds outside pretty much every village. Charnel grounds were large areas, usually near a river, where the dead would be cremated. More particularly, the dead of those people who could afford the cremation. And this still happens in India, still. And in Thailand, for large portions of Southeast Asia, they're not generally shown to tourists, but they exist. As a matter of fact, they existed in Europe in the very early prehistoric period. That's what people used to do. There was large spaces. If some of you have heard of Stonehenge, you know, that's why many people think Stonehenge was a place where you brought corpses and laid them in a sacred space, and then you left them until the corpses disintegrated, and then you either cremated the bones or buried them. There's certainly a good deal of evidence of it. So Kisukotami took the child's body to the charnel grounds and laid it underneath a tree, and then went to the Buddha. And the Dharma, in terms of people training in the Dharma, determination, when properly directed, can be of immense benefit, just as stubbornness, when properly directed. And the Buddha had this type of insight where he could, according to the stories, he could tell whether or not a person was likely to actually gain benefit from a particular teaching. So sometimes he would go looking for particular people, or when he was giving a talk in a large number of people, he would wait until the right person arrived before he would even begin the talk. And so Kisukotami, having put all this determination, if you see what I mean, one could say she was obsessed, but then there is the realization of both the existence of the universality, existence of suffering, and her perspective on it. Okay? And also how grasping can unhinge the mind, and how letting go can restore the mind. And in any case, she went to the Buddha, and the Buddha, as soon as he saw her, said, "Have you got the mustard seed?" And she said, "Enough of this business of the mustard seed. Give me refuge." And so the Buddha taught her. And as is often the case in teaching in Buddhism, the Buddha was pointing out to her what she already knew, and confirming it, and showing her how to continue on with this. As a matter of fact, the story is an excellent illustration of what later on, the teaching of what later on became the teaching of Buddha nature, that all beings have the capacity to see, all beings have the capacity to train. That one does not have to be a extraordinary person or an extraordinary wonderful person in order to train. There's a sort of modern notion that has kind of crept in with the idea that people can't train before they've got their lives in order, or people can't begin practice unless they're stable. I mean, they have to be able to sit down, I suppose. But as this illustrates, people in all sorts of situations. And also, if you think, the Buddha didn't convey to her initially anything spectacular, anything secret, any sort of special teaching. He just told her to go and look for mustard seed. Do you see what I mean? This is within the context of ordinary people living quite ordinary lives who, as I say, she didn't receive anything spectacular any more than the woman who was walking along and heard the Buddha talk. I don't know whether the Buddha would have talked about precepts, you know, but she looked into her life and had insight into where she could do better. You know, and went back and told her employer about it, having her making off with half the money for some years. I've always felt when I've been talking about training, you know, over the years, of how to convey to people that when the teaching says, you know, ordinary mind is the way or ordinary daily life, what this actually means. It means one does not have to have, great, you know, learning or be an extraordinary person in order to practice the Dharma. Just determination. There's a saying from another tradition, that's St. Teresa of Avila, the great Catholic monastic, who had very little patience with saintly people. Particularly nuns would turn up, women would want to become nuns, and she would tell them to go away because she said, "We have enough saints here already." She said, "I do not require of you great and curious understandings. I just require of you to look," which is very much along those lines. And you can see from these stories, these were not people who did, you know, sort of spectacular, unusual, esoteric means of practice, or received, you know, like secret teachings or anything along those lines. Okay? But mind you, when they would have reached a particular point and it was necessary for them to understand more, the Buddha would have explained it. But these things came out of their willingness to not look away from their daily lives, like with Kisugotami. And also that very interesting Buddhist perspective on things, or the teaching of the Buddha, that from a certain perspective, Kisugotami was insane. But to a degree, all she was suffering from was intense encounter with reality, and just needed it pointed out. And this is how Buddhist training is done in all the Buddhist traditions. Okay. One of my favorite stories is from the modern Tibetan tradition, which I've told before, where this monk has been practicing. He lived in the 50s, I think. He'd been practicing meditation, one of the great big monastic colleges. He received all the instructions in meditation, you know, what to do with the mind, where to put the body, all the rest of it. But he didn't seem to be quite, he wasn't satisfied with it. He became a meditation expert, in fact, but he wasn't happy with it. So people said, well, there's this old guy, lives, you know, by himself up in the mountain somewhere, and he's supposed to know about meditation. So this monk went to look for this old guy, completely unprepossessing. You know, nothing in this old guy to attract people to him. But he was supposed to know about meditation. And so the monk went to him and said, now, can I check my meditation with you? I'll show you what I do and you tell me whether I'm doing it right or not. So the monk sat down, presumably full lotus, putting the hands in the right position, putting the back in the right position, you know, tongue, the whole shooting match, which are the same as the instructions for us. And then, you know, lowered the eyes, began meditating, and would look up every so often towards the old guy, you know, am I doing it right? And the old guy would go like that. Nope. So the monk tried even harder, you know. You know how all the foolishness, well, I shouldn't say foolishness, but it sometimes is. People try all sorts of foolish things. They try to prevent thoughts from arising in their minds. They try to find some sort of state where they won't encounter difficulties. They try to do something special with their bodies in order to thinking that this will have a special effect on their minds. I once dealt with somebody, a young fellow, who had gotten the idea that if you sat on your heel, some of you might have heard about that, you cross your legs and you sat with your heel almost up your backside, forgive me, but, and you sat that way, that it put pressure on the spine and this would produce wonderful effects. He wasn't asking my opinion of it. He was just telling me about it. And, you know, what a waste of time, aside from, I suppose, getting funny effects up your spine from sitting on your thing for too long on your, where was I, having digressed?
The checking of meditation with the old
guy. Oh, yeah, the old guy. That's my problem. I love little stories. I go off and I can't find my way back. Usually I can't. In any case, the monk was sitting there, and this was not particularly encouraging because the old guy was, no, that isn't it. That isn't it. And the monk was doing everything he had been taught that meditation was. You know, doing various things with his mind. And the old guy kept on going, no, no, no. Until the monk became really discouraged. Okay? About this. Really discouraged. And thought, you know, as sometimes people do, oh, I'm no good for anything. I've studied this for 20 years, and I obviously don't have a clue about it. And he stopped. This all became internal. He stopped watching the old monk, okay? He was filled with the sense of, if I can put it that way, dissatisfaction with what he was doing, disillusionment. Disillusionment can be wonderful for training. It may not sound like it, you know, the disillusion, the dissolving of illusion. And then he started to think of, and it's interesting because what this monk was doing was thinking, too, for that matter. The thought occurred to him, and he thought of his teacher, of his own teacher, and he thought of his gratitude to the teacher. And then he felt the gratitude arise within him and arise and flow through him to the point of tears. And then he looked up and the old man was going like that. Because it is not a technique. We employ the basics of a technique in order to kind of remove the superfluous. You know, we don't try to meditate waving our arms around or getting up and doing, you know, what do they call it? The
yogi position?
No, yogi I meant position. More the, there's the word for dance, not the flamenco. But anyway, you know, you don't do it by holding and waving things in front of your eyes or trying to, you know, count the leaves on trees or whatever, or imagine various states of mind. But that's because you're cutting back on the minimum. Okay? Cutting back to the minimum. But if you get in your mind that you can only meditate under very special circumstances, okay, then that divorces it from your daily life. I remember there was a monk of the Tibetan tradition who asked me when he heard we were going to be doing a retreat, and he said, well, who are you going to hire to do the cooking during the retreat? And I said, we don't hire people to do the cooking. We cook. And that is the particular thing, particularly the Soto tradition, which, of course, is the as they say, is the of the Mahayana schools, is the one that mostly resembles what the Buddha taught. Of the training within daily life. And, again, coming full circle, because I think I ended the story with the old monk.
Yep, you did.
Dogen, when he went to China, Dogen was raised in the Tendai school at the time. Only imperial princes and, you know, nobility could become monks. The farmers were tied to the land. And so Dogen learned all the... Dogen was a master of all the ceremonial, including the mandalas. Everything that's handed down in the Tibetan tradition now was taught in the Tendai. So he knew all that. And... But Dogen was disturbed by the whole business of, yes, but what actually is training? And some of the monks on Mount Hiei where he studied said, oh, don't worry about that, Dogen. You're too obsessive. You know, don't worry about that. Learn the ceremonies. The emperor will invite you to the palace and you'll get to do ceremonies for the imperial ladies. And, you know, what higher aspiration can one want? And Dogen thought that this actually was not very much unlike all the old people described in the Zen tradition and the Buddhist tradition. He thought, well, that's not what they said. And also these monks in Mount Hiei said, you know, everything has the Buddha nature. Don't worry about it. Everything has the Buddha nature. You know, like, don't worry about it. And one of them said to him, you know, just learn the scriptures so you can recite them. That's all I did. And look, I'm fine now. I'm an imperial teacher. I get to wear a long, fancy robe. It's all very nice. And Dogen was dissatisfied. Dogen must have been a bit of a pain to these people, to tell you the truth. And so, because Dogen couldn't get an answer, and he was still a teenager, so he heard about this monk who had renounced the world, who had been abbot of one of these big temples, and was living in this little hermitage, reciting the name of Amida as his practice. So Dogen went to see him. And the old guy listened to Dogen, and he said, for you, an ordinary answer will not suffice. Go down to the capital, to Kyoto, I guess, at that point, and see Eisai. Eisai has just returned from China with a new perspective on training that they call the Zen tradition. So Dogen went there and studied with Eisai, but anyway, eventually went to China. Dogen arrives in China, is on the boat. He decides to stay on the boat for several months and learn Chinese. He was one of the few people who did learn to speak it. And this old monk comes down to the boat to buy mushrooms. Japanese mushrooms were highly prized, major trade item. Shiitakes, I suppose. And so Dogen talks to the old monk, and he wants to invite the old monk to stay to talk some more. And the monk says, well, tomorrow is the Vesak, Festival of the Buddha's Birth and Enlightenment. I'm the cook. I'm preparing a special meal for the community with these mushrooms. I can't stay. And I have to get back before sunset. And Dogen says, but surely there are other people who could do this for you. You know, back in your temple, you probably have got lots of staff. And the old monk said, I don't understand. This is the training of my old age. And Dogen says, but yes, shouldn't you be doing something other than cooking? You know, shouldn't you be studying koans, you know, profound koans, or spending like hours and hours meditating? And Dogen reported that the old monk laughed out loud. And he said, you poor foreign person, you really do not understand what training is about, do you? And so Dogen says, well, what is training about? And the old guy, being Chinese, slightly poetic, said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Dogen asked for clarification, and he said, nothing is hidden. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 means, you know, you train by walking along the path. And nothing is hidden means you don't need anything other than your body and mind and instruction. Later on, Dogen went up to visit the old monk, who gave him further instruction in regards to this. And there was another older monk up there who was very old. He was bowed over and his eyebrows were white. And he was drying mushrooms with a stick in the hot sun. And Dogen, again, being an aristocratic Japanese, said, why are you working so hard in the sun? Shouldn't you get somebody else to do it? Very modern, well, that very modern attitude, if you know what I mean. Shouldn't you get somebody else to do it? And the old guy said, I don't understand. What other person? This is my job. This is what I do. This is my training. How could I have somebody else do what I need to do? And this story about Dogen and the old monk is very much the same as the stories I've been talking about in the Buddha's lifetime. It was ordinary people paying attention to what they were doing, trying their best, not thinking that if only they got to the right state that everything would be solved. Because many people, remember Master Ji used to say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Not 2, 6, 11, 24, you know, leaping all over the place. But rather 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.